Hi everyone, welcome to All Things Creative, also known as Art Chats. Today I have Deborah Kearse with me, and we are going to be talking about a never-ending journey. So Deborah is going to share with us what she's been up to and how she got there and why her journey's never-ending, why I guess any artist's journey is really never-ending. May have some detours along the way, but if we kind of stop learning, we sort of stop that journey, I think. So Deborah, welcome. Good to see you again.
Well, thank you for having me again. I'm truly honored. Thank you, Linda.
Yeah, it's I keep track of you on Facebook. I'm kind of one of those quiet stalkers that goes through the news feed and go, oh yeah, that's really kind of cool, you know, and all that kind of stuff. So noticed some things that you have going on and thought that it would be kind of fun to have you back on the show. The first time that I had you on, we actually had the WAM group on. So why don't you take an opportunity or take a few minutes? Well, first, let's back up. That's kind of later in your journey. I want to get to the beginning of your journey first. And tell us a little bit, how did you get started painting or drawing or being creative even?
Well, everyone has those stories. You know, I was a young child in a Detroit suburb, and I have one like that. My mom had an interest in art, and she had this book, and I don't remember who the author was, but it was a charcoal drawing book kit with a train on the cover, I remember, and then all kinds of pages inside with showing how to do 1-point perspective, 2-point perspective. And of course, I didn't know what that was at the age of, I don't even know, like 5, 6, 7, 8, whatever I was. But she had it kind of stored away and hidden underneath the basement stairs and the, you know, where we had our laundry room area. And so it just felt like I was sneaking or something, I guess, to go and play with it. And so I would go down there when there was a quiet moment, like on Sunday mornings or whatever, and I would sneak, which I'm sure she would have let me use it, you know, but I didn't want to take risk that she'd tell me, no, don't get the charcoal over you or anything, you know. And I would go down there and draw. So that was when I think my acknowledgement or love of art began. But it continued on through, and that was in the 1960s, it continued on through high school. I graduated in 1979, and I had done a year as the city illustrator for Sterling Heights, Michigan. Mm-hmm. I would go there from noon to 5 every day after school my senior year, and worked on their logos and their key lining, which probably nobody knows what that is anymore, but basically the newsletters. We did some cartooning with creating a book and a character for kids, and all kinds of fun programming. But and a calendar, monthly calendar, I did that. But the gist of it was I knew that I didn't want to be an illustrator. Mm-hmm. I wanted to paint. I wanted to paint like, you know, Rockwell or Vermeer and Rembrandt and the old masters. Mm-hmm. And people were saying, well, you could do Norman Rockwell type things, but he's an illustrator. And so that would mean you'd work for a magazine or you'd, you know, illustrate children's books or whatever. And it never sat right with me. That wasn't really what I wanted to do. And whenever I would say, no, this, I'd point to something in a museum saying, this is what I want to create. Being in the 70s, they said, no, here's the modern art wing. This is this Bouguereau stuff and all that. Like, forget that. That's so passe. You don't want to do that. You want to paint like Rothko. And I mean, I don't want to insult anybody who loves abstract art, but I would look at that and go, I don't get it. I just don't. And so I got a scholarship to Cranbrook Institute of Art, which is a prestigious place to go to college for art in Michigan. But I turned it down because they were teaching contour drawing and, you know, concept art, basically things that you could then graduate and make money doing, right? And I'm like, I want to make money, but I don't want to do this. And so I was smart enough. I really had my pick of whatever career. So I went, back then you'd go to a library, and I went to the library and found this big book on careers, and I'm like, okay, what's the hardest one? And what's the one that makes the most money? And basically wound up getting a degree in biochemical engineering because I could, because I hated chemistry. So I'm like, I'll challenge myself. And so I did. And that was fun. And I did that. I was the biotech industry, an engineer for the biotech industry in New England, and then at Eli Lilly and Company in Indiana. And I did that until 1997. And all the time I was doing little, you know, commissions for realtors, people's houses, or, you know, people portraits, pet portraits, all that kind of thing, sort of on the side, and selling them for like $50, $75. And that was fun. I did a lot of, back then it was a lot of charcoal to begin with, and a lot of graphite, and then I started getting into watercolor, and then it was pretty much acrylic all the way up until about 2012 or so, when I started really pursuing, and I had been all along obviously taking workshops and things, but I really started pursuing classical realism painters with a vengeance, you know, people that I admired, and sort of a self-directed study, or continuing my self-directed study. And everybody that I loved, their work was using oils. And so I learned pretty quickly that you could do things in acrylic, but it was easier in oils. And so that's kind of, in a real short version, my art career story. And I didn't say, in 2010 is when I started doing art full time. I left engineering in 97, but I was a stay-at-home mom, and you know, you're kind of busy during those years. So I continued to build my commission business, but it wasn't until 2010 that I said, okay, I'm going to do this for real, and you know, get some gallery representation, which I did in 2012, and take it from there. And so it's been, what is this, 2019 now? It's been, you know, almost 10 years, and they say it takes 10 years to really kind of figure out what you want to do, where you want to go with it, and what your story is going to be, what your journey is going to be like. And for me, that's been so true. I feel like I'm right on target. You know, I can see now this is where I belong. This is what I'm doing. So that's my story.
Yeah. Great. Yeah. I kind of like perked up because you said 1979 and you are doing all these great things. Sorry, that was my phone that just went off. Go put that in a drawer. Anyway, I graduated also in 1979, and there's like a big difference between you and I. You were actually like already drawing and taking art classes probably, and all that kind of stuff. And I was the one that was sitting out there, you know, at that point I was writing spoofs on different Hollywood films that were out. And things like that. So both creative, but just in different ways. So it's really kind of amazing to hear that, you know, this took hold back when you were, like you said, 5 years old, and, you know, it's still a passion for you today, right?
Yeah, it is. And it's funny you should talk about authorship, because when I was in fourth grade, I remember that summer, I was such a nerd, I was a total nerd. I still am, but that summer in fourth grade was when my brother was born. Mm-hmm. So I guess I was nine when he was born, so I must have been 9 or 10 at that point. But he was born, and I think probably I was just having like mid childhood crisis or whatever, you know, being the oldest and then having the fourth kid arrive here. But I spent the entire summer writing a little novel. And so I've got it somewhere still. I kept it, you know, because back then you used typewriters to write things with.
Right? Oh, yeah, and yeah.
I wrote this mystery novel, but nobody would read it. And I had little newspapers that I put out every week for all of them. And then when I started charging them a quarter each, they wouldn't pay for it. So I'm like, you know, it's just too hard to be an author. It's too, I can't get any appreciation. Whereas anything I drew, people would, you know, reinforce that. They'd all, you know, compliment me about it. So I'm like, it's much easier being an artist than to be an author.
Well, it's still difficult, I think, being both in today's world. But yeah, you have to have that commitment to keep it going. And, you know, at some point we all find our tribe and people who appreciate what you're doing, which is a good thing.
It takes us
a while to get there. So so you got to the point, you have children, you were raising your children and working and trying to fit in some creative time at that point, I'm assuming?
Yep. I think all throughout your life, if you're a creative person, you create, whether it's through cooking or through photography or through whatever, you know, in my case, I have two boys and a girl. And so I was, you know, the mom who did all the, obviously art, but also engineering, merit badges, and the, you know, all the Boy Scout, Girl Scout, 4-H, youth group, all the stuff our kids were involved in.
Right.
I wasn't so good at being the soccer mom. I really didn't like sitting in tick-infested fields, but anything that was creative, you know, I was the room mom. I was on everybody's list for Uber volunteers to decorate the school plays. I was always the decorator for that. And my kids also inherited that as a result, because two of them were very involved in drama, and my daughter is actually graduating in May with a degree in digital media production, so she wants to create and edit films, and then she's going to be moving to Los Angeles to do that, she thinks, and then you know, the boys are very creative in their ways as well. So I mean, it all, whatever you do, it I think you can't hide it, you can't put a lid on it. So for me, art wound up being the place that my creativity landed, and I'm happy for it too.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're happy too, because we get to look at your work. So.
Oh, thank you.
And purchase it for sale. Put that little plug in there too. So tell me a little bit about, as I said, I interviewed you and the Wham Ladies, and I really enjoy keeping up with that as well. Out on Facebook, there's a group that you can join and all that. So tell us, how did Wham start? And how do you guys, I mean, like Carrie, I think, is still in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And you all don't live in the same city, which is kind of amazing that you all stay so supportive of one another, and you have this commitment to one another. So how did all that come about?
Well, it's funny because now, you know, like you said, we're lifelong friends. We call ourselves the Wham Sisters these days. and actually, Kim and Helen just spent time together out in Sarasota, and they're in their respective homes now. But I'll be going with Maria to Tokyo in March of next year to see Carrie again. But she's going to be stateside in September for the watercolor conference. She's doing a workshop down in Florida. So we'll all four of us will get a chance to see her when she's stateside, because she's going to be doing a couple of shows here in the Manassas area, there in Virginia as well, that I'm helping to organize and stuff. So we have these things where we all, even though we're all over the world, we all get together. We were everyone but Carrie. We were in France, the south of France, together in what was it, October, just a couple months ago. And so yeah, we see each other quite frequently. But anyway, what it is, we've got this group that we formed in, I want to say 2012, 2013. I'm losing track now, but it was right on the time when I was really feeling like, you know, you can do so much more in a small group in terms of art projects, like getting into museum shows. You know, it's so hard to create 50 of your own paintings, but if there's several of you working together, you can do that and you can put on a show, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's, you know, all different kinds of experiences that we've had through travel and through just any number of things in where we've supported each other. And I got that concept from Leslie Seda's AHA radio show. And she mentioned, you know, bringing together a small group, a mentoring group to, you know, do this, exactly what we're doing. And so we got together, and what we like to say is the spirit of business and friendship. And it was originally a different membership, but you know, people come, people go, and we kind of gelled. I think it was right around 2013, 2014, into the five that we have now. And can I mention those five? Can I name
Absolutely.
Them? Okay. So as you said, there's Carrie Waller, who's out in Tokyo. Her husband is in the military, and so they are deployed, or whatever they call it when they put you somewhere and you live there.
deployed, <they're>, right?
Dakota Air Force Base, and so that's where they are. And she is an amazing watercolor artist who loves to paint still life and a lot of the scenes from, you know, fairs and things going on over there where she is in Asia. And then there is Helen K. Beecham, who lives in Charleston, South Carolina, and she does these beautiful watercolor paintings of the local architecture and houses in her area, Low Country. And then there is Kim Minichiello, who spent a lot of time over in Asia. And so she likes to do things with sort of an Asian flair, but she's especially fond of painting architectural details. And she also is a watercolor artist. And then there's Maria Bennett Hawk, who lives in Cary, North Carolina. But it's confusing because her husband is still doing contract work for the Pentagon. So they actually do have a home that they're renting here in Arlington, Virginia. And so I see them often because, you know, they're in my neck of the woods too. And she is an oil painter, and she loves to paint portraiture. And I, of course, paint what I paint, which I don't know anymore. I just say I paint what I fancy because I paint everything. I've never really settled down into one genre per se, but I do specialize in painting miniature fine art. So I paint anything from 2 inches all the way up to 4 feet tall. So about half of my work is in miniature and half of it is larger. And even the larger things, I apply a lot of my miniature techniques or process to that as well. So those are the five of us in WAM. And as you can see, we are all different media. We're all different locations geographically. So that opens up the world to us for opportunities. We're actually going to have a show that Carrie's organizing out in Tokyo in March. And as I said, I've got one here that I'm organizing for our group in September at the Northern Virginia College in Manassas, and then also the Art Center at the Candy Factory in Manassas in April. We're going to have a show there as well. So we've got a number of things in the pipeline, and I know that there's always places in Charleston that Helen's looking at for us, and also there might be some other things happening as well. But we've always got projects going on. We've always got, you know, things personal and business related to talk about. And of course, Helen is going again to a castle in France this time that she's going to be teaching at. The one I went to with her, where Kim and Maria and their husbands also came along, was in the Perigord Retreats. It's an art retreat company where it's in near Gourdon, France, and it's in I'm probably butchering all these names, but the Dordogne, D-O-R-D-O-G-N-E region of France. And
Gourdon. Sorry.
Okay. I mean, I'll take your word for it. Everyone there was British. I didn't speak to anyone in French. I didn't have to speak any French, like, not that it could, but they were all British, because it's an area where a lot of the Brits have come and retired there, and they're renovating all of these old, and when I say old, I mean medieval age homes.
Yeah, I biked through there.
Oh, it's gorgeous.
It is.
And it's so safe. And it's so, like, I found my happy place there. And I've got probably 5,000 different pictures that I'm planning to paint for the rest of my life. I also hope to get back there in another year or two. If anybody's interested, let me know and I'll put you on my list. I'm not going to teach, but it is an all-inclusive retreat where Angela's a gourmet chef, and she feed you what you want, you know, to your dietary specifications and everything. And then they pick you up at the airport and take you each day to a different, you know, medieval castle or these prehistoric caves 70,000 year old cave paintings I got to see, Linda. I mean,
yeah,
you're like, you're looking at them and you're going, why is this here? Like, whoever did this, man or woman, had to risk their life with their little torch and their chewed up manganese and ochre that they, you know, probably had to spit in to make it into a paste so they could paint this on the wall. And they had to fight the stalagmites and stalactites to get there. And if their torch went out, they were dead. Like, why aren't they out there making baby Cro-Magnons or chasing, you know, food or something? I mean, yeah. I mean, it's the Ice Age. It wasn't like it was a very safe place to be during, you know, snowstorms and things. So I don't know. Right. But it was just a very life sort of transforming experience, and I want to repeat it and go back there with a group of people. And so I'm just going to collect names, and then when we're ready to make this happen, I'll contact everybody and say, so do you want to go for 10 days?
Yeah.
So
it is a gorgeous place. It's really kind of interesting, as we went there and cycled bicycle through that whole region. And again, it was, as you said, there are a lot of expatriate British folks living there. Not sure what's going to happen with Brexit, but I know there's a lot of people that are there having the same question. I have friends with some folks on Facebook that are living in France, British folks that are living in France, and they have a question about, you know, how are we going to be able to stay and what are we going to need to do? And it seems to change day to day what they're going to need to do. So I'm sure it's very frustrating and somewhat fearful for them. But the place that we stayed was just outside of Gourdon, like you. And then they would drive us out, and then we would bicycle to a place. And the directions were always fun, because while we were eating breakfast, John would be going over the course that we were going to be bicycling. And he would go, so you're going to go down halfway down the hill, and then you're going to turn right. I've never been on this hill. What's halfway down the hill?
So yeah, funny.
We would always get in these conversations. It's like, well, what's halfway down? Okay, you turn right at the dustbin. What's a dustbin? He goes, you'll see it. You'll know what it is. Just turn right at it. And I'm like, okay. So it was a lot of fun doing it, but and it was gorgeous country, just gorgeous.
Well, the thing I loved about it is, you know, you go to some places, like when you go to Tokyo, I painted several pieces from there. And, you know, I don't think people really in Western culture relate so much to the happy cats and to some of the things that I painted.
Right.
And you go to this area and you could be in Charleston, you could be in, you know, Italy, you could be in, I mean, it definitely has a European kind of edge, but it could, there's so many places in the United States, there's a lot more people that can relate to it. So in terms of content for what you're going to paint, I think that it was just, you know, everywhere you turned was a painting. And it was, you know, just, I thought very inspiring and unlike any other place that I've traveled to. So
yeah,
that's why I want to go back another time. But yeah, I mean, it's just, it's safe and it's beautiful and it's, you know, some what is the name of that? There's a walk that you take through Portugal. A friend of mine was doing it.
Oh, yeah,
actually, from Portugal and Spain, and it goes right through the Gordon region of France there.
St. James.
And by the,
Saint
but
James.
No, it was,
nope.
It started Camino walk or something.
Yeah.
But anyway, there are a lot of people that do that pilgrimage that go, and some of them, you know, have cabs take them from one location to the next, and then or they'll walk in and they'll have somebody deliver their luggage to hotels or whatever. Other people actually do the camping thing, and
right,
you know, just like you would on an Appalachian Trail or something. But there's an actual there's a booming tourist trade through this area. So to know that, I thought it was just amazing that you feel like when you're walking in these you know, little towns, you're on these back streets and you can hear people singing as they're making their dinner, and you can smell the cooking smells, and you can hear the birds chirping and stuffing and stuff. It's like, it's something out of watching a Disney Snow White movie or whatever. And yet you're in this area that so many people love to visit. So that to me was amazing.
Yeah. And it was really interesting for us. Not only were we in Gordon and that area, we stayed for about 18 days, I guess. So we started off in Paris, took the train down to Gordon, from Gordon, took the train all the way down to the Mediterranean, across, and went, basically, we were on one side of France, we did a wine tasting tour, and then the other side, we kind of biked through. So it's kind of interesting, hopping on the train and going up to Avignon, and then up to Beaune, and then up to Reims. We call it Reims, they call it Reims, and then back to Paris. So we saw all of Paris, or all of France at that time, and the light is just so different there. I mean, you would think we're around the same parallel that the light would be the same, but it's not. And it's just, I don't know, it's just hard to explain all the differences. I guess maybe because it was so new, it just leaves such an impression on you. And, you know, it's one of my favorite places to go back to. I'm waiting. So.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'll put you on my list. The, you know, all these art, the travel keeps me inspired. I mean, mm-hmm. probably everybody would say that, right? But, you know, like last year I was in a different state or country every month. And, you know, this year I have several trips for the same thing. I could list all the different states and places I'm going to be. And I never expected that out of an art journey.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I traveled quite a bit when I was in engineering, but it was, you know, you could be in a beautiful location. And, you know, when I was in the Alsace part of France in Fagersheim, I was in meeting rooms the entire time. You know, I might as well have been in Pittsburgh or someplace. I mean, it didn't matter.
Right.
So getting to really go out and travel in a way that you experience with all of your senses, these different locations, is something that I really appreciate in my art journey, you know, and it's part of why I so value this time in my life right now, because, you know, the people inspire me too, you know, meeting all these people. And I was surprised, as I said, that they were all expats, the Brits that had moved in there, because I could speak to them. I didn't really fully expect it to be like in Montreal, you know, everybody put up with me there because I can't speak French. But, you know, and then the art experiences, of course, like you said, the lighting is different. And, you know, my experience, I thought it was pretty transformative in that grotto in the cave there. And just, you know, like I sat on the toilet in King Richard the Lionhearted's bedroom, you know, because I could, nobody was looking. And, you know, just having those sorts of experiences puts you in a different frame of mind when you're then painting it, you're remembering and recalling and enjoying them all over again. So,
Did you have a chance to stop in at Giverny?
No, but we, maybe next time. I don't know. I mean, Helen chose the places we went to, and we went to a new place every day. And I know she had a whole list of things to choose
Right, yeah.
from. So I think this next trip, I'm going to do different stuff. But
Yeah, well, make sure to put that on your list because it is interesting seeing the difference with what you think Giverny is based on all the different shows that you watched and all the paintings of Claude Monet and all that. And then you get there and you're like, wow, this is interesting. And I'm not going to say any more than that because I don't like ruin anybody's experience when they get there. But it was very different than I expected it to be based on everything that I had seen prior to being there in person. And it wasn't a bad thing. It was wonderful. It was a wonderful experience. So if you yeah, I would definitely put that on the list of, yeah, I have to go there to see it if you're gonna go back.
yeah, I mean, of course, there's all kinds of other places on my bucket list too. I've got friends in Australia that have offered me lodging and cars and things when I go there, and I'm like, okay, that's got to happen,
Oh yeah,
So
absolutely.
maybe on the way to Hawaii or something, I don't know. But all these different things, like I said, that I don't know what I always say this. I don't know what I would paint from if I was 22 years old and just getting out of college with an art degree and saying, okay, go paint. Like, what would you even do? It's all, I'm so glad that my life played out the way that it did, because I have all of these life experiences as a mother, as a traveler, as a, an engineer, as a wife, as a everything to draw from. And I think it's what keeps all of us inspired and keeps us, relevant, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And as we named the show, it is a never-ending journey. I'm assuming if we do stop that learning, if we stop getting some kind of inspiration, that creativity kind of begins to stall and then you kind of begin to lose interest because you're not expanding that. So I know there's probably a lot of things that you could say about that because of that, and everybody's journey is unique. You have a very unique journey yourself, so.
We all do, right? I mean, I think, there's a lot of times when I'll do things like visit museums and you draw a lot of inspiration from there, but you look in the walls and you go, okay, am I doing this right? Because, whoever, John Singer Sargent or Mancini or like name your favorite, painter,
Right.
they were doing blah 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 by the time they were
Yeah.
and you can always compare and think that maybe you could have done something different, or you should be doing something better, or how come there was a Vermeer exhibition here at the National Gallery of Art in DC that I went to with Maria, and we were talking about how Vermeer was one of the artists there, but quite honestly, Ter Borch has always been my favorite, and there's a number of his contemporaries that were also in the show that had better pieces than some of his, even the ones that we know, right? Better in terms of, our opinion, obviously, who are we? But we're just saying, how come it is that he got noticed so exponentially more in history than these other folks? And Maria said, well, maybe it's because he's well documented, maybe he had notes or whatever. So she's been journaling and keeping notes and everything. I'm like, well, then they're all going to know about you because I throw all my drawings away after I transfer them. There's such a pain to keep around. Like, well, who wants them anymore,
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, I don't know the reasons for why some people get noticed or they don't or whatever. But for me, I'm like, you know what? As long as I can leave this world feeling like I became and did the best that I could do with my talents, then I'll be happy. Because even if nobody remembers who I am after all is said and done, at least it's I've lived and experienced this journey, and it's for me it's been incredible.
Right.
So, but you asked about people losing their spark or their creativity, right?
Right.
Were you asking me if that ever happened to me? Because that's like a common question that people often ask.
Well, okay. Has it ever happened to you? Okay,
Not
next
yet.
question.
Not yet. And I think the reason is because one of the things that I try and do, and having the Wham creating the Wham group was one of the things that, or founding it or whatever, was probably one of the smarter things I did. But I always try and step outside my comfort zone as much as I can. So having said that, I'm trying to think now, scrambling in my brain, what is it? I know something I'm doing that's out of my comfort zone. I've got in September, I'm going to be part of this thing called Mountain Splash that's happening in West Jefferson, North Carolina. And it's an artist's retreat, or like a Woodstock for artists kind of a thing. It's patterned after the splash that they have in Elizabeth City. And that whole area around Asheville, North Carolina, and Appalachia there is a pretty artsy area that I'm not that familiar with, but I have friends in. And so I'm going to go there, and I'm going to stay for a week and be a part of this art fair. And I can't even remember the last time I did a table fair. It was probably like, I don't know, maybe 2014 or something that I did one of a couple of the local ones here, you know, where you bring all of your art and you set up and you've got a table and you've got a tent or whatever, you know. And that to me has always just been something that every time I've done it, I have not enjoyed it, but I've never done it at an art retreat before. So this will be, you know, something new for me. And then also in July, I'm going to the Ann Arbor, where I went to college at the University of Michigan. They have an art fair every July, and they've got I think it's like four separate fairs that are combined into one, but they have the entire town now. It used to be just two streets when I was in college there, but now it's the entire town shuts down to do this art fair. So they've got people from all over the world that come and sell their wares and stuff. Yeah. So I'm going to try and immerse myself more into the art scene this year, the art fair scene, which is something that, you know, you can only do so much. So I've kind of set that aside for the last decade or two. So, I think as long as you're always trying to push yourself out of what is comfortable and try something new, and you know, you might walk away from it and say, nope, that wasn't fun, I'm not doing that again. Or you might have the most amazing experience, like, you know, with the Wham group, where I can't replace those ladies, you know.
Right.
So I think that's helpful if you run into one of those creative glitches.
Yeah, you know, I think an outsider looking in, one of the things that I think could be said, that if you are somebody that struggles with staying inspired or keeping the passion alive, because, you know, there's day-to-day things that happen to all of us, that Wham group that you guys have formed, I think, is just so inspiring to each of you. And it's almost like if I could tell somebody what to do, it's like, go do that. Go find those kindred spirits that keep you passionate and keep you inspired, and might say, Deborah, why don't you try doing this? Or, you know, or Maria, yeah, why don't you try doing that? Or whatever, you know, but just the fact that it's coming from somebody who's supporting you as a friend, you know, they're not trying to tear you down. They're not trying to lead you astray. You don't have any doubts when somebody mentions something to you, because that group is so cohesive and so together. At least from the outside looking in, I mean, sure, you guys have your disagreements, but because everybody's human, but it just seems like it's just one of those things that keeps you all of you on track.
Yeah, I you're absolutely right. And I don't think that I don't think we've ever had a disagreement. We've never had any kind of an argument or obviously, you know, we have different opinions of things, but we've never had any kind of a, you know, like, women are, the stereotype is that they're catty and they fight a lot and they're competitive and all that. We've never been that way. Good. But the reason is, I think, is because at the outset, we made it very clear. And this is why we had some people that, you know, came and left from the group, was because, not that they didn't agree with this or whatever, but it just wasn't like they were looking for something different. Right. Mm-hmm. But we said right at the outset, we said, we're going to be a shared leadership group. So nobody's in charge. We're not doing, you know, that whole hierarchy thing. We're all at the same level, and we want to recognize and embrace that we all have different goals, and we all have different perspectives, and we all have different journeys. So, you know, whereas your journey might be to get into museums, your journey might be to maximize sales, your journey might be to teach, your journey might be to host workshops or whatever, you know, we all are doing something different. And in that way, because we recognize that everything has value and that we're embracing this diversity, we're not in any way competing with each other. So it's not a matter of, you know, oh, you got into this contest and I didn't, or, you know, it's easy to support each other when you know that we're all different, and we're all different ages too. So, you know, the perspective from someone who's 10 years older than me versus the perspective from someone who's 15 years younger than me is a lot different. And so you get different opinions that you can weigh, and then you take from it what you need, you know? Mm-hmm. So if you're creating a group like that, I think that was one of the things that we did that worked, was to find people that are like-minded through the arts. And obviously we have, you know, some probably similar, like we're all nice people, right? We're not, mm-hmm. we're low drama people. And, you know, you find a couple things that you have, your core values are aligned with, and then just look for all the things, as much as you can, the people that are a little bit different and work in different mediums, maybe different ages, maybe different locations, maybe different goals. But if you have people that are all the same, I think you get too much of that competition and too much of that infighting, you know?
Right, right. Absolutely. So, in speaking of stepping out of your comfort zone, I know that you're not doing very much of this any longer, but I do want to talk about it. And that's, you decided to start to get yourself out on YouTube and record some small little videos that provide some advice. I think you said in the green room that you were basically answering some common questions that people mm-hmm. were asking you. So tell us a little bit about the journey of becoming Deborah, the YouTube star.
I don't know about a star. My daughter is the film person, and she's like, "Mom, I could help you make these look so much better." And I'm like, "Yeah, maybe one day I'll get into trying to create videos." There are a lot of artists out there who do. I like watching, like Cesar Santos does a good job, and Proko does a good job. But for me, the whole purpose of it was to put some things out there that I get, you know, random things that I get asked an awful lot, and that I thought are things that if I knew them, they would be so helpful to me, but nobody ever talks about them, right? Like
right.
some things like when you, I think I did one on how to clean your brush cleaner. Like you buy these things and the first time you get it, you're like too embarrassed to ask anybody, but how do I get this clean? Because there's this wire thing and I can't get it out of the glass thing. And, you know, so little silly things like that. But it was also because now I can just, if people have those questions, then I can just send them to that link, right? Right. And it takes a lot of headspace when you're trying to remember every time, you know, how to answer something. So now I can just go, okay, here. And who was it, Einstein, that said, I don't ever have to remember anything, I can document. So now I don't have to remember any of that stuff because it's out there. But it's called Deborah Kearse Art Journey, and it's on YouTube. And I did one every week for an entire year. And I very well may go back to doing them again. But for now, I'm just taking a little hiatus because I've kind of run out of, you know, those random important things to talk about. And I don't want to just get out there and talk because that's silly. There's a whole bunch of stuff out there and shipping and doing shows and preparing art. And oh, I don't know, just a whole bunch of things that I put information out on.
Yeah, it's interesting because I was interviewed last week by Buzzsprout is a podcasting company, and I go through Buzzsprout to distribute and keep a record of all of my podcasts with them. And it was really kind of interesting because the guy said to me, he says, you know, he says, Linda, you've been doing this for 6.5 years. And I went, have I? And he's like, yeah. And I'm like, really? And he was like so surprised that I didn't know that I've been doing this for 6.5 years. And I said, wow. I said, you think by now I would have ran out of things to say? And he just started laughing. And I was just like, okay, evidently like it's not unusual for podcasts to last a year and a half, maybe 2 years at the most, and then kind of disappear. So I evidently have one of these long running podcasts, but the reason why I'm bringing that up is because one of the things that I kind of took a little hiatus, and I've kind of changed directions a little bit on my journey, but I've also, you know, it's part of me to paint, it's part of me to write, but it's really kind of interesting is I just got tired of asking the same questions of everybody. And, you know, there's not that much diversity in the world when we start talking about creativity. And one of the things that I had always been interested in was whether or not the creative process was the same or different, whether we're talking about music or making a movie or painting a painting or whatever. And it's interesting how the creative process is so similar in no matter, you know, what genre we're talking about, whether we're talking, yeah. And I'm not just talking like watercolor versus oil painting, because people would say, are you crazy? There's a big difference there. There is, but there are these things called, you know, creating your foundation and then doing your value study. And, you know, all of these things, they're parallels. So So it was kind of interesting that, I mean, that was just like a real big, oh my gosh, I have been doing this for 6.5 years and people are still listening, bless their hearts. So thank you for
well,
that.
Congratulations on your longevity there. That's amazing.
Yeah. It's, yeah. And I'm glad that people still listen to some of the older ones. Again, he was blown away with the fact that I had like over 27,000 listens to one particular art chat. And it gets listened to a lot. I mean, that number is continuing to grow. So, and that was just, like I said, that was just one of the art chats that we had done that were big. Most of them.
Which one was that?
That was the one where I interviewed Sherry McGraw about drawing.
Oh, okay.
And there are some that are over 5,000. There are some that are in the 2,000 or 3,000 range. So it's nice, and congratulations on getting something out there on YouTube to live for eternity, really. I mean, you were talking about the caves and how the people did that. YouTube and podcasting and all of that, the whole reason why I started the podcast was because I wanted to talk to artists or creative people and actually get something down for the record. So 100 and some years from now, your voice is going to be heard by someone who's just starting out, and think about that inspiration and the passion that you may be bringing to them through this nice little talk.
Yeah, that's a wonderful thought. Yeah, we were talking about this in the green room, as you call it. But it's kind of funny to me when I've got a number of people that I mentor, or I've been asked to go and teach workshops, privately at different locations for people and stuff. And even the one I have coming up in March here that I'm hosting here, I'm always amazed when I take so much for granted. And so I think when you're in a teaching situation is when you notice that the most, right?
Mm-hmm.
If I imagine you find that too, where you're, like, don't you guys know this already? And, because you've said it, not that people should, but because you've said it over the last, in your case, 6.5 years or, however many years you've been painting or whatever like this, there's so many things that you take for granted that you think everybody knows, And
yeah.
So why would anybody want to hear from me? What do I have that's special to say, but. In truth, we all are special, right? And that's, I guess, what makes yes. the journey so exciting.
Yeah.
We all have it. Yeah.
Yeah. It's kind of interesting, is the one thing that I think all of us kind of take for granted, but yet see the struggle when you're teaching with beginners mm-hmm. is mixing colors. And, it's like, what? You just, it's kind of like when we were out playing air painting one time, one of the students, and I was out with Kevin McPherson, who I was working with at the time. And we were all out painting our Monday morning, stand in front of the pond and get one done before we actually, had the formal workshop going. And I remember standing there painting, and somebody goes, how do you mix brown? And it's like, just mix all your three colors, your primaries together. So it's just like, but we take that for granted, because we've been mixing colors for so long. It's quite daunting for folks that are just starting out, even if they have an array of paint from the tube in 20 different colors, they're still like sitting there going, I don't have the color that I need. And how do I make that color? So it's, mm-hmm. I think that every time I hear that from my students, I kind of take a step back and go, you need to remember what it was like when you first started painting. And I'm sure you teach as well. So you probably, there's probably we could probably list a number of questions that we hear that just kind of throw us for a loop, like, oh, wow, I thought I covered that already here. Thought you were further along or something. I don't know.
Well, the funny thing about stuff like that, Linda, is, like, I've got a kind of a cool perspective here, because I've hosted a number of people to come, and I've got Juan Ramirez coming here in June. And then I'm going to have, she's not on my schedule yet, but I'm going to have Tina Garrett here in November. And, just thinking of those two workshops that are coming up and the one that I'm teaching, and then also the conferences that I've attended. I know you're involved with the track, and I'm going to be going to the Face to Eric Rhodes Figurative Conference this year. And I've also been going to the Portrait Society of America Conference every year. Mm-hmm. And all of these different places. Oh, and I'll be in March, I'll be at the opening for the National Acrylic and Oil Painters Society at R.S. Hanna Gallery. There's a number of demos that are going to go on there. All these places you go and you get to witness all these different artists and how they do the color mixing or the this or the that or whatever. And you listen to the same questions, being asked of them again and again and again. And every one of them, what is so intriguing to me is every one of them has a different answer. And mm-hmm. you wouldn't think there'd be that many answers to the same question, right?
Right.
But there's truly every artist does it a little bit. Some of them will just be like, I don't know. I mix this and this, and then I look, and if it's redder, then I add this, or if it's, you know, bluer, I add that, whatever. And then you'll see them, you know, 2 years later, I'll host them again, and their answer will be different again because they're growing as well, right?
Right, right. As I say, I think it all depends. I think the answer is dependent on where they are in the journey that they're having.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's a cool thing that it changes. Like, some people might be annoyed that it's different from, you know, I know one student was kind of annoyed. She's like, gave me a different answer than you did last time. But I think that's pretty good because you don't want to be learning, or I shouldn't say that. I might offend people, right? I forget that there are people are listening. It's not just you and me talking, but you know, you I think get a better learning experience when you're learning from someone who is also really pursuing an active learning as part of their career, as opposed to someone who says, okay, this is it. I'm never changing again. And this is, you know, as good as I'm going to get. And here's what I have to share with you. So I don't know. I enjoy that there's so much fluidity in all of these questions and answers and experiences.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And if it becomes too much of a formulaic thing, personal opinion, if it becomes too much of a formulaic thing, I think that's when you get bored and you end up, you know, kind of walking away from it instead of constantly trying to, you know, learn something different or try something different. And when I sit, when I'm saying that, I sit there and I think about somebody like Kwan Ho, who clearly steps out of his comfort zone a lot to do a number of different things. And the basic foundational skills are there. I'd love to see some of his mistakes. You know what I mean? It's like the gorgeous paintings that I typically see. But, you know, again, maybe he doesn't have mistakes. I don't know. But
I'm sure he does.
Well, I'm sure he does too. And he's just smart enough not to share them with us. But
that's one thing they do at the Portrait Society conference every year is they have the 12 artists who do the face off, you know, where they paint for 2 hours. And I'm always amazed. And one time I was talking to Teresa Oaxaca and she was saying, well, you know, people can say no. I mean, we're not forced into doing this, but I was saying how, gosh, you know, they expect so much of you because they want you to paint this incredible piece in 2 hours. And then, you know, it gets sold to benefit the society. And so it's gotta be a good one and everybody's judging you and you're on these screens and everything. I'm like, doesn't that get nerve-wracking? Cause as a, you know, I paint everything, but I mostly paint still life. And so I don't know how much you'd have to pay me. I'm sure I've got a price, but to get me to go and do that, you know, I don't mind doing demos. I have a lot of fun doing them for people and all, but you know, to be in a situation where you're up there and being judged like that, I don't think it's fair to do that to artists. I don't like those sort of scenarios. I mean, at least not as the artist in those. I mean, I enjoy watching the face off immensely, but right. So, and you know, I think that, everyone has their comfort level or whatever. And maybe some of them just don't care if they paint a dud in front of everybody, you know, maybe that would be okay for them. I don't know.
Well, I think what needs to be said is that there is so much preparation that goes in to that before it actually happens. I mean, you know, Teresa just doesn't show up and start painting. She's been painting live, you know, in front of people probably for a couple of weeks before that, just so that she can get in that comfort zone. She probably does it, and she does it a lot. So, you know, it's not, if you do want to get out of your comfort zone, sign up for something to do something like that, not at face naturally, but, or track or anything like that, but, you know, just even a local thing and you'll find out, you know, just how much work goes in to preparing for that, for these artists. I have a lot of respect, as you do too. I'm not saying you don't. But you know, there's a lot of respect there for the amount of effort that gets put into, doing something like that and being in that comfort zone when they do those demos up on the stage. And it's kind of amazing because, and I had a lot of, I guess you could say I had some exposure to that preparation with some of the artists that I've worked with, in the past and watching them prepare. Joanna Arnett is another one who puts a lot of time and effort into preparing before she does a workshop. And a lot of it is, you know, making sure that when she gets up to do her demo, that she's ready for it because she's been doing all the painting ahead of time for that. So kind of interesting. It's a different thing. I mean, it's not something like Teresa said, you know, you can say no. It's obvious something that she, I think, enjoys doing. So otherwise, why would she be doing it?
Yeah, and that's her thing, is doing, like you said, the alla prima portraiture is her thing. And right. Maria, too, actually, having said that, we were at the Candy Factory where we're going to be having that show in next year in the spring. And I volunteered Maria to do alla prima portraiture. I'm like, she can do that. And I'll do an interactive still life demo. And
I didn't even think. Yeah. And that's still, that's still, I think, stepping out of your comfort zone, because this is something that you're prepared to do, but you're going to be doing it live. So don't get all choked up. I didn't mean to make you nervous.
No, I'm fine doing my stuff live, but like you pointed out, it's not necessarily my thing, but I threw Maria out there because it is her thing to do the operation. So yeah, you can paint a live model and I'll just paint a live plant. Yeah, we're good.
Yeah. And it's kind of interesting too, because when I teach, I also paint with my students. And a lot of times what I find is, like, I'll go around and I'll work with them and give them suggestions, and we'll talk a little bit about, some theory or that theory. And then I'll go and I'll start painting. And it's interesting because they'll stop at certain points and come over and watch me. And it's actually helped them, because they'll say, now, how did you do that? Or what did you do? Or what are you thinking here? And they'll actually catch me at a point where I'm creating and I'm in that space where I can tell them something different than if I were just in that teaching space. So it's kind of interesting the way that all of this kind of works together for the benefit of folks to see and to learn from. So some folks aren't up for that, and that's totally cool. Totally get that. So
yeah, there's all these little groups. Do you find that in the art world where you've got people that are seeking knowledge from each other, and then you've got people that are maybe just beginners, and then you've got people that are put in that master category, but still actually enjoy sitting in on each other's workshops? That happens a lot, mm-hmm. Or just people that are hobbyists, or, like, there's all these different little groups. And when you're in one of them, like we always talk about when we're at the Portrait Society, just keep reminding yourself that even though you've got all these amazing people all around you, and I'm sure it's the same at Track and Face and all these others, plein air conferences, you've got people that are stars in that little environment, but then when they go out into the real world, they're just normal people, right? I was at in Santa Fe with a friend, and we were at a cafeteria type place, and David LaFell walked in to get takeout, and she's like, "Dad, look at over there." We're probably the only two people in here who even know who he is, and then he's married to Sherry McGraw, your most popular podcast, and yes. but it's like, you kind of forget, because we're in our own little circles, and then you go into step into another one. If I walked into a plein air show, I wouldn't know half the, I'd know a few names, but I wouldn't know most of them, so yeah, it's all
relative.
Definitely little discrete paths.
Yeah, and it is interesting, because that's not only, that's not just the art world that happens, and it's pretty much happens to all to everyone. I think I could come up with situations where it happens in even in the hometown that I live in. So pretty cool. So I think we hit the YouTube, and we hit WAM and teaching and hosting things, just so that we can get some stuff in. Tell us a little bit about painting miniatures. How do you approach it? A little bit about your process. And I know you said 2 inches up to 4 feet. I think the 4 feet part, I always just assume that these are very, very small. I never knew that you painted, larger than a couple inches. So tell us a little bit about your process and your.
Sure. When I paint in miniature, I use a magnifying glass, a lighted magnifier. So when I'm painting something that's, 4 feet tall, I'm obviously not going to, well, maybe it's not obvious, maybe people do, but it would take me a long time to paint the whole thing under a lighted magnifier, and it would hurt my eyes when I was done. Mm-hmm. So I only paint parts of those in the miniature process or the miniature style. But basically what you're doing when you're painting in miniature is you're paying homage to the masters back before the photography age, where you know, if you wanted to have a picture of someone who was dear to you near your, you had a miniaturist paint that and you kept it. It was usually on ivory or on some other, you know, not canvas and not, it would be something smooth where they could get a whole bunch of detail in there and it would be able to fit in your palm and in your pocket, right? Mm-hmm. Or you could turn it into a pendant. So what you're doing is you're paying homage to those artists of yesteryear. And it all started back with the scribes in the medieval ages. So this is a genre of fine art painting that is steeped in history and in, you know, lots of different, like there's the Russian lacquer boxes, there's the scribes, there's the icon artists, there's the miniature artists that you usually think of with the portraiture. And if you go to like the National Portrait Gallery or to even the Gibbs Museum in Charleston has drawers. They're usually in drawers. You pull them out and you see all these beautiful little miniatures on ivory. But today, what miniature means, and you can go to the International Community of Miniature Artists, ICMA.org, or to any number of different societies, miniature painters, sculptors, gravers, Society of Washington, D.C., MPSGS.org, the Miniature Art Society of Florida. There's a number of different sites to get more information on this stuff. But the main umbrella sort of organization, the Miniature Artists of America, and I'm proud to be one of their signature members. There's only like 60 or 70 of us that are active, meaning we're breathing alive in the world today that can say that we have that signature membership. It's kind of like the holy grail of the miniature world. But the description that that we embrace is, and it can be different for every show, different for every, you know, gallery that displays miniature art, but the gist of it is 25 square inches or less and framed in a way that is suitable to the small stature of your painting. In other words, if you were to take that painting and blow it up so that it was, you know, a 5-foot painting, it would still look good in the frame. It would still look good under that amplification. So that means that you have to pay attention to the minutiae, the way things are framed. The corners can't be badly mitered, and the mats can't be overcut. And if you have a matted piece and the actual work itself, you pay attention to the details. And also, it has to be in most shows 1/6 its original size or smaller. Hmm. And people sometimes confuse it with dollhouse miniatures, which are 1/12 the scale. It's kind of like in the train collector world, you've got, you know, trains with different fractions. Right. Well, 1/6 or smaller is what we talk about when we talk about true miniature art. And that is just because the human head, which is typically a 9-inch head, when you put it down to the size that they had in the miniatures, the pocket miniatures in Europe, it was at 1.5 inches or less. And so when you look at 1.5 inches, you know, that's 1/6. So there's all kinds of little rules like that. They get into, like if you're doing bugs and flowers and things, they give you an exception. If you have a great amount of detail, then, you know, it's kind of hard to make a bumblebee 1/6 its original size. But then there's shows like the Seaside Art show in Nags Head, North Carolina. They have a show at that gallery every spring where they don't have the 1/6 rule. They just have the size rule. So mm-hmm. you can find different rules in different places. But there are thousands of miniature artists, and there are hundreds of shows all over the world. There are a lot in Pakistan and in you know, a lot of Middle Eastern countries and Russia. I've had work shown out in the World Federation of Miniatures in Russia and also in South Africa. And so it's not just an American thing, but the two biggest shows here in America are the Miniature Art Society of Florida show, which happens, actually it's hanging right now. It happens every winter in Dunedin, Florida. It's actually at the Leap of Ratner, which I think is in Tarpon Springs, and the Dunedin Art Center in alternate years. And then there's the MPSGS, which is in Washington, D.C. here, which hangs at the Strathmore Mansion in North Bethesda, Maryland. So those are the two largest ones. And when you walk in, they'll give you a magnifier to look at the art through so that you're actually looking at it the way it looked when it was being created.
Yeah, cool.
So that's fun and different. And it's just, if you've never been to one, it's a fun thing to do, to go to one of these shows and to see the work like that. Now, I do about half of my work is done in miniature, and then about the half is in larger sizes. So like the solo shows that I had last year, I had one at the at Ellis Nicholson Gallery, which is closed in November, but in Charleston, South Carolina. And I had one in Seaside Art Gallery in Nags Head, North Carolina in November. And for both of those shows, I had, I think, maybe 7 or 8 miniatures, and the rest, I had about 20 in each show, and the rest were larger pieces. So we don't all do just miniature, but it's certainly fun, and it opens a lot of doors and gives you kind of a different perspective on art in general. Plus, it's a fun community of people. I've got a group of friends in the miniature world, and I'll be meeting up with them when I go to NOAPS in March, and then again when my daughter graduates from her college in Arkansas in May. So it's kind of fun to get to know all the people. And I think the reason I stayed with it and got so embroiled in miniature art in the beginning was because of the social part.
Okay. So you've been doing miniature since when?
Since probably 1993, 95.
Okay, cool.
Something in there. Yeah, so a long time. But and then there was the ASIO groups on eBay. ASIOs are art cards and editions and originals. They're still on eBay. There are still groups in there, but they're different kinds of miniatures. And so depending on what you want to do, if you just want to, you know, play and do fun little things, or you know, if you want to, this what I was talking about just now with the miniature art, the True Miniature Societies. These are, you don't go in and you don't buy one of these paintings for $50, $75. I mean, somebody spent probably a week, you know, or more to just on the painting part of these. And so, you know, generally the average price is around $300 for a true miniature art painting. Mm-hmm. So even though they're small, they take twice as long or three times as long as a larger painting to create.
Right, right. So always interesting to hear a different approach to things. So I know that you had said earlier that you had a list of things that you wanted to touch. Have we touched on all of those?
I think we have. I wasn't really paying careful attention, but I think we did. I guess I also had down here my contact info. Do you want me to tell?
Yes, please. Where
okay, so if you wanted to sign up for my e-news or see my art or see what events I have going on, I keep all that current on my website, which is debkart.com. And I did it Deb for Deborah, K for Kearse, because nobody can remember that I'm E before I, the exception to the rule. So, debkart.com. And everyone looks at it and says, Deb Kart. I'm like, yeah, well, close. my Facebook page is facebook.com/Deborah Kearse, E before I, exception to the rule. And my Instagram and Twitter handles are at Deborah Kearse. And then I'm represented by Seaside Art Gallery. I'm also in the Selma Gundy Club in New York City and in the Copley Society of Art in Boston. So I've got work that's hanging there generally whenever there are shows. And then I'm in the Online Art Renewal Center. They just announced that I'm their newest living associate master artist. So yay.
Yeah, and, congratulations.
Thank you. And so my work is in their museum online as well. And so between all those places and more, I try and keep everybody current on what I'm up to and where I am.
Yeah. So we've enjoyed having you on the show, Deborah, and appreciate the time that you spent with us and talking about your journey and you know, helping to keep us inspired. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much. And you can call me Deb. You can call me Debbie. You can call me Deborah, whatever you want.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I had asked you earlier if you wanted Deborah. So of course, I have friends that are Deborah that I call Deb. So that just kind of like slipped out. So
it's all good. I'm so happy to have been your guest. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, it's been a lot of fun. So, and thank you everyone who's tuned in to listen to us talk about Never Ending Journey with Deborah today. And we'll be having some more art chats and all thing creative podcasts through this year. It'll be my 7th and a half year, I guess, at the end of this year. So anyway, make sure you check back. Thanks again, Deborah. I appreciate it. And lots of, you know, luck come your way. And looking forward to keeping an eye on you on Facebook in different places. So thanks again.
You as well.
Yep. Okay. Bye-bye, everyone. Thanks for tuning in. Bye.